The following podcast is provided to you free, as is all our content, at drhoffman.com. If you'd like to listen, help support Intelligent Medicine, and get great values by shopping at our supplement store, go to drhoffman.com and click on Shop, then click on the store. Thanks, and enjoy the podcast. Welcome to the Intelligent Medicine Podcast. I'm your host, Dr. Ronald Hoffman, and a very happy Independence Day. I hope that you are doing something fun and recreational, or perhaps you're on the way to the beach or to a vacation destination. And we have something special in store for you on today's program in keeping with the holiday. Today, we're going to talk about a Declaration of Independence. But it's not the original Declaration of Independence. It's a modern-day Declaration of Independence by today's guests. It's the Physician's Declaration of Independence. And it starts out pretty much like the regular Declaration of Independence, but it's got a different slant. So I'll give you an example. We hold these truths to be self-evident, that the physician's primary responsibility is toward the patient, and that to assure the sanctity of this relationship, payment for services should be decided between physician and patient, and that, as in all transactions in a free society, this payment be mutually agreeable. We're going to delve into the Physician's Declaration of Independence with today's guest. He is the author of self-same Declaration of Independence, Dr. Richard Amerling. Dr. Richard Amerling is one of my colleagues here in New York. He is Associate Professor of Clinical Medicine and an academic nephrologist, which means he's a kidney doctor who teaches doctors and lectures at the Beth Israel Medical Center in New York City. And he has written and lectured extensively on healthcare issues. He is also President-elect of the Association of American Physicians and Surgeons. We'll find out more about that organization in just a few moments, because everybody knows about the AMA, the American Medical Association. This is a organization of doctors that has a slightly different orientation. He's also a seasoned speaker and on-air contributor. You may have seen him on during one of his frequent TV appearances. So without further ado, here's Dr. Richard Amerling. Richard, it's a pleasure having you on for Independence Day, and it's quite apropos, isn't it?
It is. Thanks, Ron. Really appreciate it.
My pleasure. Well, you know, first of all, why do doctors like you see the need for a Declaration of Independence, and why should patients and the public even care about it?
Well, this is actually, I think, the 11th anniversary of my actually writing the Physician's Declaration of Independence, although it has been updated regularly, the latest being after Obamacare was passed, because doctor independence, first of all, is crucial. If you're a patient, you want your physician to be representing you and your best interest and not working for somebody else, and particularly not working for the government. The government has a long history of abuses, and not just our government, but all governments. They want to impose their version of medicine on individuals, which is usually something akin to public health at its best or eugenics at its worst. So you want a physician who is not going to be beholding to the government, not going to be beholding to a third party, who will step up and represent your best interest.
Well, you know, it's interesting because you actually, you don't, the most of your work, you're a nephrologist. So you see a lot of patients in dialysis, patients with kidney failure, patients who need transplants, or you monitor them after transplants. And I'm not that familiar with your practice, but it's a hospital-based practice. So why should you care whether it's the hospital who pays you, the government who pays you, Medicare, Medicaid, you know, all the money just kind of flows through to you? Does it really matter whence it comes from? Is it a single-payer system or an insurance-based system? Why does that matter for your practice?
Well, ultimately, he who pays the piper calls the tune, as they say. So doctors are being increasingly constrained to practice a certain type of medicine that is based on, shall we say, practice guidelines, this cult of evidence-based medicine, and is not really driven by science that much anymore. So it is not always in the patient's best interest to follow along with these protocols. In the old days of Medicare, for example, there was expressly written into the law that the government would not interfere with the practice of medicine. And there's nothing that says a government has to interfere with the practice of medicine, and there's nothing to say that a single-payer system couldn't even work if it were structured in such a way that it was voluntary and that it was non-binding. In other words, if the government wanted to support payments for medical care, they could do that in a very non-invasive way.
They could say, you can sign up for this, or you can, you know, it's like you can keep your doctor, or you can sign up for our program. We're offering this as like an ancillary program.
Right, and the key thing is that the patient pay the doctor directly, and then they are in control of the relationship, and they can assure confidentiality, they can assure that the doctor's really working for them. And then if they want to get reimbursed from the government or whatever other third party is involved, they can do that. But the relationship between the patient and physician should include a direct payment. And that is, I think, the core of good medical practice. And unfortunately, it's observed rarely these days, if at all.
Well, you know, to be the devil's advocate on the subject, you know, a lot of doctors are uncomfortable with the monetary aspect of medicine. You know, perhaps lawyers get a little better grounding in business. And for many doctors, it's an uncomfortable thing. You know, I'm offering you potentially life-saving medical care, but make sure that you pay the receptionist.
Right. In history, in ancient times, physicians were paid what's called an honorarium, which is a gift that honors. And that is really what it was. Because how do you put a value on a physician's service? Now, in the old days, physicians could do almost nothing in terms of actual good medical care. And they were more often than not sages and handholders and spiritual advisors more than anything else, although they, of course, could describe diseases, and that goes back to ancient times. But they couldn't really do very much in terms of treatment. However, they were paid well, and I think society has, over the years, understood that you want your healers to be at least financially independent. You don't want them worrying about how they're going to cover their rent or mortgage or whether or not they're going to be able to send their kids to college.
Well, because it introduces more of a monetary incentive into practice that might cause you to make decisions like ordering more tests or more involved treatment protocols for patients when something simple would be easier?
Well, there is that temptation in the fee-for-service system to order tests and to do more and more to enrich yourself. And that is balanced out by the Hippocratic ethic of doing no harm to the patient and acting in their best interest. But it's true that if you're being financially constrained by lower and lower payments, which is what's happening with our third-party system, doctors are getting less and less for their unit service, then you are going to be falling into that temptation more and more. I think it's unwise for doctors to be struggling financially. And this is how I put it. You know, because the people throw at me, well, look, what about the Hippocratic Oath? Aren't you supposed to?
Yeah, it's an altruistic profession, right?
Exactly. What about the altruism? And I said, Hippocratic Oath is not an oath of poverty. It's not like you're becoming a monk. You expect to make a decent living for your time, the time that you've invested in your education and your training, which is extensive, as everybody should know.
Extensive and expensive. And there, you know, there's many a day when, you know, we during our medical training might have wanted to go partying, but instead we had an organic chemistry exam and had to put our nose to the grindstone.
Exactly right. We deferred a lot. We went through, I went through 10 years of postgraduate training.
Right.
And you don't get paid very much during those years.
Some people say that, you know, when a song comes up from the 1980s or a movie, some people say, don't you remember that? And I go, no, because I missed the 80s.
I
wasn't around. I just, you know.
Right. Well, you know, I also say, look at the other professions and ask yourself the simple question. How would you feel? Would you feel confident in seeing a lawyer who is getting paid $30 to see you?
Uh-huh.
And that's, as you know,
or if your airline patient, your airline pilot were making, you know, 22 grand a year.
Right. Exactly. So you probably wouldn't feel too confident in a lawyer that was getting paid $30 to see you and getting paid by somebody else who doesn't have your best interests at heart. And that is a situation that physicians are increasingly in. They're getting paid by a third party a ridiculously small amount to take care of patients who are increasingly complicated and difficult.
Well, you know, you introduced a couple of terms here, guidelines. Well, what's wrong with guidelines? Because, you know, we certainly need guidelines for medicine, because otherwise everybody would be very creative and they'd just be making it up as they go along. Aren't guidelines good? Shouldn't they be imposed by insurance companies, the government? You know, you can do this, but don't even think about doing that.
Well, guidelines are fatally flawed for several reasons, and I could devote a whole hour on this,
yeah.
I have.
There's actually an agency that's empowered under Obamacare to set up guidelines. It's called the IPAB, the Independent Physician Advisory Group,
right.
Or something, right?
And there are government guideline agencies. The AHRQ has been around for a long time, and there are professional societies create guidelines, and guidelines are ultimately paid for mostly by industry, and industry uses guidelines to encourage doctors to overprescribe their products, and it's
wow.
become advertising by the back door under the pseudoscientific guise of practice guidelines. That's the short problem with guidelines. They're also,
in other words, we could give us an example. Might be a certain drug is shown in testing to be a beneficial drug, say for hypertension, and then it gets incorporated in, quote, the practice guidelines, so that physicians are almost required to use that medication, because if they don't, it's considered bad medicine.
Yeah, sure. And the practice guidelines over time have lowered and lowered the definition of what constitutes normal or acceptable blood pressure. So they ensnare more and more healthy people into medical therapy unnecessarily. And somebody with a blood pressure of 140 over 90 now may find themselves encouraged to start antihypertensive therapy, and there is really no evidence that they're going to benefit from that. And the evidence comes from these very large industry-funded studies looking at tens of thousands of patients, where they, because of the massive numbers, they can produce a statistically significant relative benefit of taking the drug versus a placebo, when in effect the clinical benefit is really negligible.
Right.
And that's the evidence base for a lot of these recommendations, including statin therapy for high cholesterol, antihypertensive therapy, therapy of type 2 diabetes. They're based on these very biased studies that are industry financed.
Well, you know, it's interesting. If you don't mind, Richard, speak a little louder into the receiver.
Sure.
Because we're
sure.
Yeah, okay. So what's interesting is, you know, whenever I get together with Richard Amerling, he is a conventional physician. He treats patients who are suffering from hypertension due to kidney dysfunction, kidney failure. He is an academic physician at a major hospital here in New York, and not a holistic physician like me. You're perhaps open to the patient using vitamins or natural products, but it's not what you push. That's not your area of medicine. And yet, we've come to very similar conclusions about some of the problems with guideline-based or even evidence-based medicine. That's another a term that's being thrown around a lot, evidence-based medicine. I mean, it sounds like motherhood and apple pie. Of course you want your medicine to be evidence-based. You don't want it to be superstition-based, do you?
Well, that was very clever of them to take that title, because it does exactly that. It suggests that they have the high ground and that everybody else is using intuition and practicing voodoo medicine. When, of course, that's not true. And evidence-based medicine has not been around that long. It really dates to the early 90s. And it was the product of this guy Cochrane and others.
The Cochrane collaboration, which actually it rates various therapies and medications. You can look up the Cochrane collaboration. You can see their reports on a wide variety of medical therapies and interventions, correct?
Right. I read a fascinating book, which I want to recommend to you and to your
yep.
audience, called Tarnished Gold.
Yeah.
Have you read that?
We've actually interviewed the author, but it was a couple of years ago. We should bring him back. But tell us about the book once again.
Yeah. It's called The Sickness of Evidence-Based Medicine. They do a top-to-bottom demolition job on evidence-based medicine, beginning with what they call the ecological fallacy, which is reasoning from a large population-based study and applying that to an individual patient.
Mm-hmm.
There is simply no way you can do that. And that is the fundamental basis of evidence-based medicine. So from just right out of the gate, they destroy the whole thing. And they go on, and they talk about how evidence-based medicine never really cares that much about causality, about what actually causes diseases, that you end up with a model based on multiple risk factors. And you know as well as I do the standard response of a doctor who doesn't know what's causing the disease is that it's multifactorial. And this all comes straight out of evidence-based medicine. And it encourages, sloppy thought. And we forget how to reason inductively and use probability theory in treating our patients, which is how we've treated patients for decades before mm-hmm. evidence-based medicine. So it's an extremely good book for doctors, particularly to read.
Tarnished Gold.
Tarnished Gold, right. The Sickness of Evidence-Based Medicine. Steve Hickey is one of the authors. Mm-hmm. Another author, I forget her name.
I believe we had him on a couple of years ago, but we're due for a reprise. I think that's a great topic. So give us an example. You know, you obviously love medicine because in spite of all the frustration that you experience in dealing with the bureaucracy, the insurance companies, the government agencies, the audits, the this, that, and the other, the hospital bureaucracy, I mean, it's really tough being a doctor these days. You keep slogging at it. You're idealistic. You don't want to abandon it. You want to change it. But give us some examples of how on a day-to-day basis you encounter obstacles to what you consider good medical care.
Sure. Well, one of my most common arguments is over the treatment of type 2 diabetes. There, the endocrinologists and the general internists are pushing drugs like crazy to try to get the blood sugar down and the hemoglobin A1C, which is an indicator of long-term blood sugar control, down below, 7.5, 7 even, when studies have shown that this does not benefit the patient in terms of any hard outcomes, such as living longer or having
right.
less kidney failure. And in fact, the ACCORD study, which was the biggest and best study looking at tight control versus usual control, showed that the patients who were treated with tight control died at a higher rate, and they gained 10 kilos
yep.
on average.
In other words, you fix the numbers, and that looks great because maybe cholesterol is better, maybe the blood sugar and the hemoglobin A1C are better, but the net result is the patient dies at the same time, or even you may hasten the patient's demise with all these medications.
That's right. And when you think about the pathophysiology of type 2 diabetes, it makes sense that this would occur because it is not fundamentally a disease of hyperglycemia. Hyperglycemia is just one symptom of what is called the metabolic syndrome, which is what they really have, and that is a chronic inflammatory disease caused by overeating with central obesity, and it inflames blood vessels, leads to early vascular disease. Hyperglycemia because of insulin resistance, not insulin deficiency, and high blood pressure. And the way to treat these people, as you know, is to get them to lose weight. When the medications such as insulin and sulfonylureas all cause weight gain,
right?
Then what are you doing? I mean, you may be improving the blood sugar control, but if you're making them more overweight, you're actually hurting them.
Yeah. What about, directives? You know, these days sometimes, although I'm a little bit off the grid when it comes to insurance companies and Medicare, I don't participate in Medicare. And, we help our patients get insurance, but we don't, quote, accept insurance and, just send patients on their way. But I still get directives from insurance companies. This patient, you diagnose the patient as having hyperlipidemia. How come the patient's not on a statin? I get letters. They're sort of like, they're like the medical equivalent of fat letters, like reprimanding you for not doing something. And many times I'm undertaking, as you suggest, very aggressive nutritional therapy for a patient to avert the need to be on a blood pressure medication or cholesterol medication. Do you get that pressure all the time to put patients on drugs?
Well, I get these letters, as you say, and I immediately circular file them.
Okay. I do, so, but sometimes I wonder if I'm going to get in trouble. It's like, you've thrown out 400 of our letters so far. We're going to come after you.
Well, they may. I mean, that's the threat, obviously, is that you're going to be paid based on how well you fulfill these guideline criteria and click the boxes and report all these data points to the government and show that you're doing what they want you to do. And this is what's happening more and more through the electronic health record.
Right, which is another thing that is highly touted because, you know, we know that medicine is sometimes dangerous, and there's been a real call to action to use a systems approach, electronic medical records, computers, and so on. Because, I mean, you wouldn't think of flying a plane blind without all kinds of computers and various types of electronic assistance just on by the seat of your pants, so to speak. So doesn't it make sense to have some kind of computer guidance system that reminds the doctor, oh, you know, are you really sure you want to do this? Because we suggest, you know, that under these circumstances, you know, you'll actually get the computer to talk to you and tell you, under these circumstances, we recommend this, this, and this.
Right. Well, this is one of these areas that sounds reasonable, but when you actually get to the implementation, it doesn't quite work out that way. And what I have found with electronic health records is that they are extraordinarily time-consuming and distracting. First of all, they require, because of the so-called meaningful use criteria, that you enter, and repeatedly enter, lots of data that is irrelevant to the reason you're seeing the patient. And so it's distracting. You're sitting there facing...
And actually the temptation is to sometimes cynically enter the information like check, 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 check. And that actually can introduce error because, you know, after a while you may check that the male patient that you've seen, that you did perform indeed a breast exam because it's check, 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 check.
Exactly. And there's also a tendency to copy the previous note.
Right.
So we are getting to what I call now cut and paste medicine, mm-hmm. or copy and paste medicine, where you're taking the previous note, copying it, and putting it in as your current note. And so errors that are in the system tend to get magnified and repeated over and over again. You know, our patient satisfaction surveys at the hospital went down after they instituted the electronic health
right.
record.
Also, the doctor tends to be peering into the computer, which you know, patients really don't get it, that it's that the doctor is really involved with that patient's care. But there really is something about looking at a patient, listening to a patient, making eye contact, rather than peering into a device and typing in information.
There is, exactly. And when I see a patient, because we now are being... forced to use electronic health record in the clinic, I explain to them first, you know, look, this is the electronic health record. I have to deal with it.
Right.
So please excuse me if I turn away from time to time and type in a few things and do some mouse work, because I really would rather just be sitting here talking with you. And I do try to have a time where I'm just talking with them and addressing them and looking them in the eye.
Uh-huh.
And then I keep the typing and stuff to a minimum. But it is really invasive, and it interferes with the patient-physician relationship.
Well, what about the workload? Because in order to, you know, frankly, if the reimbursements are so low, I've heard that a lot of my physician colleagues who are working with insurance companies or working with HMOs or in a hospital system or with Medicare, they have to see far more patients, so the interactions are very brief and superficial.
Sure. Well, that's what's happening for years, is that the reimbursement to see a patient, the payment to see a patient from a third party has been declining in real dollar terms, so that to make ends meet, you have to do higher volume, and that decreases the time spent with each patient. It also increases costs, interestingly, because you're cycling more and more patients through your system, sending more and more tests, requests for consultations, even hospitalizations go up. And this has been widely known. I mean, the central planners in Medicare must know that every time that they have lowered physician reimbursement, total spending on Medicare has gone up in the years that followed that cut.
Well,
the SGR has never really been implemented, because that is a system that says that if total Medicare spending goes up a certain amount year to year, then the physician payment is going to be cut the following year. But that would then cause the cost to go up even further. So they've never really implemented it.
Wow. Actually, a true life horror story. I talked to a patient the other day who went to the dermatologist, and the dermatologist said, you know, you have four suspicious areas here. And the doctor biopsied the two areas and then said, okay, please come back and we'll do those other two areas. And the patient said, well, you know, why can't it took you like 2 minutes to get these two areas? Why can't you just get these other two areas? And the doctor kind of hemmed and hawed and finally says, look, I have a lot of trouble getting back here. Could you please, I mean, you know, in consideration of my time, like charge me more, but please cut off these two extra areas and tell me if they're cancerous. And the doctor said, okay, but I'll tell you the real reason why I can't do all four at once is because they only reimburse us for two, and we'd have to have another visit for me to get reimbursement for the other. But he says, I'm losing money, but I'm gonna do it anyway. And you know, in a sense, I'm giving you these services for free because they dictate that you can only do two at a time. Wow, that's really inefficient.
Yeah, well, that's a good example of how the reimbursement system dictates practice patterns, and this is what happens all the time. Medicare, other insurers, of course, follow the Medicare lead. So what they start usually gets picked up by the other insurers. Let's say they started to cut payments for doing an office electrocardiogram. Well, suddenly they're not being done. Now, you can argue, are they really that valuable? But the point is, it controls the practice. We used to get paid extra for doing our own urinalysis, and that was actually
right.
A key part
mm-hmm.
of the yep. of the evaluation of a patient with kidney failure.
Mm-hmm.
Now, and they stopped.
Okay. And you can see it. It's beautiful because you can see right away in the office, you know, you say to the patient, look, we're going to dipstick your urine, we're going to check it out. And before the patient left the office, you could find out if they have urinary tract infection, if they have blood in their urine, if they have protein in the urine, you know, you could actually make a clinical decision and act on it right away. Now you send it to a lab, and next day you get a result, and by then the patient's off and running.
And it's not as good. I mean, the urinalysis yep. that we did was very high quality. It was almost like a poor man's kidney biopsy.
Well, you as a kidney specialist, you would peer under the microscope and you would yeah. see all kinds of things that would help sure. you with your interpretation.
Sure. You and I, I'm sure, learned the art of the Gram stain during our
yes.
training.
That was
an incredibly useful test to do, especially in the emergency room setting. Patient would come in with pneumonia or an abscess. Let's say you get some pus or a specimen and you do a Gram stain and you can identify the microorganism right then and there. I mean, yeah. it's incredibly good, and I don't think doctors are even learning to do this anymore.
No, because it's all, you know, mostly, you know, you send it out to the lab and you get a lab report on a computerized sheet. All right, this is a good inflection point for us to pause because let's stipulate this is part one of our discussion of the Physician's Declaration of Independence. It's the 4th of July, and y'all are celebrating, but there's little to celebrate from the standpoint of medicine, because more and more doctors are under the gun, and that means that your medical care and the sanctity of your relationship with your doctor is being threatened. This is the premise of today's guest, Dr. Richard Amerling, and we'll return in part two and talk more about the Physician's Declaration of Independence, and we'll talk a little bit about the VA crisis. So what went wrong in the VA hospital? Dr. Amerling has his own ideas about that subject. I'm Dr. Ronald Hoffman, and this is Intelligent Medicine.